Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 604, titled Kicking Over the Traces, being recorded on July 15th of the year 2007. And we're going to plunge right back into the story of how tremendous economic power and derivative political power, and occasionally just plain old ordinary deadly force or the threat of same, has been used over the years to kick over the traces to cover up the Borman Capital Network, about which I speak so often. Note that there are very firm indications that the Bush family is a primary element of that network. And what we're going to do is to go right to, For the Record, or an excerpt of For the Record program number 152, side A. This was recorded in February of 1999, and this information is basically about the cover-up of the publication of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Note the tremendous power put by German corporate interests, including the Bush-linked Thiessen family, a primary element of the Bormann Capital Network, on people who were going to publish Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. So in turn, from For the Record 152 from February of 1999, two excerpts from a now-defunct publication called News World from August 24th and August 25th of 1982. The first excerpt from the first part of that article from August 24th of 1982. The following is from the News World of Tuesday, August 24th of 1982. This article is entitled, Publishing Conspiracy to Deep Six Bormann Book. I'm going to read the article, which is self-explanatory, and for those not familiar with the Bormann organization, an explanation is evident in the context of this story. The introduction to the story begins, Journalist Paul Manning thought he had a bestseller when he tracked down Hitler's chief deputy, Martin Bormann, in Argentina. Much to his surprise, however, several publishers turned down the manuscript of his book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, after lengthy perusals. The reason, he discovered, was that Bormann's Nazi-funded industrial empire is today, and bear in mind this is 1982, powerful enough to reach into New York's publisher's row and threaten any firm brave enough to print a story that endangers its interests. The following is the first of a two-part series on Paul Manning's fight to publish the facts of Martin Bormann's existence. Part 2 will appear tomorrow, and part of Part 2 will be read into the record in a minute. The main body of the article reads, Martin Bormann, Adolf Hitler's wartime deputy Führer and legal successor as leader of the worldwide Nazi Party after the fall of Berlin, is alive and well and living in luxury on his 200,000-acre Argentine ranch. From it, he directs a global business empire. He made it safely out of Germany to Buenos Aires in 1947, following the first Nuremberg trials at which he and 12 other Nazi leaders were convicted as war criminals. 10 were hanged in the gymnasium of Nuremberg prison. Only Hermann Göring and Bormann evaded this fate. Göring took his own life by means of a cyanide capsule that had been smuggled into him. Bormann, convicted actually in absentia, for he had been in hiding ever since the night of May 12, 1945, made his way to South America, where he assumed command over the enormous hoard of liquid assets he had sent out of Germany during the last years of World War II by means of the 750 corporations he had established in neutral nations to guard and to increase this German treasure. Note the next paragraph, because it's part of the great significance of the Bormann organization. Month by month, new firms are being launched across the globe from monies generated by that core of 750 companies, originally set up in Portugal, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, Turkey, and Argentina. When I tracked Martin Bormann to South America and then wrote a book about it, I thought it would be easy to get it published and I envisioned a worldwide bestseller. But this was not to be. I had not anticipated the resistance to the Bormann saga by established wealth and power. Bormann's escape and his subsequent existence in Argentina was West Germany's best-kept secret, until I opened it up with my book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. It told too much about powerful people who had collaborated, and still do, with Bormann and his organization in Western Europe, the United States, and South America. My book ran counter to their personal interests. Too many still do business according to Winston Churchill's admonition to his war cabinet in 1943, quote, truth is so precious that she should always be attended by a bodyguard of lies, unquote. Those I approached for information, whether in government, industry, or banking, whether in Washington or in foreign capitals, were more interested in protecting their secrets and the flanks of their peers than in any revelations for the sake of history. They see the war is still on,
and they erected a bramble of lies that I had to cut through to reach the truth. The working title for my book had been Conspiracy of Silence, because it described exactly what I had been up against. The firm that finally had the courage to publish my book, Lyle Stewart, thought Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, would be more commercial, and perhaps it is. But no title would have placated the opposition to me. Publication of my book is quietly forbidden in West Germany, just as it is in England. Bear in mind, this was written, this article is from August 24th, 1982. The two Germanies were still divided at that point. Continuing, the intensity of this opposition was reflected in the decree by the West German government against Quick magazine, a West German news weekly. Quick had sent a five-reporter team to South America to get material for a magazine series on Bormann's presence and the scope of his operation in Argentina, and on his close ties to German industry and finance and political leadership in Bonn. According to Ladislas Farrago, author of Aftermath, which placed Bormann in Argentina, who gave me these facts before his death, they got the story, but never published it. The West German equivalent of the FBI descended on the publishers of Quick and warned them that to print this story, quote, would not be in the national interest, unquote. If this warning were violated, the magazine would be closed down and the five reporters and their editors would be imprisoned. The decision against Quick had been made at the highest levels of the Federal Republic of Germany, and obviously the order had come right from the presidential palace in Bonn, Farrago said. The West German president, Karl Karstens, was quite understandably disturbed over the prospect of the Quick revelations. He had been a Nazi Party member during the Third Reich, just as had his predecessor, Walter Scheel. This should not necessarily have interfered with the U.S. publication of my Bormann book, but it did. One noted New York publisher and his editorial staff rejected my manuscript and explained in a letter to me, quote, "After a lot of talk and a lot of meetings, we have decided to step aside. But there is no question in my mind that you have transformed your idea into a book and a potentially saleable one, and I wish you luck with it," unquote. Later, I learned that this publisher had strong business connections with West German publishing companies and obviously thought it imprudent to publish material on West Germany's Verboten list. Another renowned New York publisher contracted for my book, and all was going along merrily until my contract was abruptly and without explanation voided. The decision to back off from publishing my Martin Bormann book was made not by the editor-in-chief who wanted the book, but by business executives at the highest level of the publishing house's holding company, who had received whispered warnings against it from Washington. Another New York publisher entered into a contract with me, complete with two advance payments, indicating satisfaction with my book, then, assuring me he was making progress with it, kept it locked away for a full year until the contract ran out. I then took the book to Lyle Stewart, who had the guts to publish it. But several years had gone by thanks to the others who had followed warnings to keep it away from the reading public. I learned that one of the publishers who had let me down was owned completely by Dutch-German shareholders who were obliged to comply with any request from Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, grandson of Fritz Thiessen, the original financial sponsor of Adolf Hitler. The Count today controls the Thiessen Steel Group, West Germany's largest from Buenos Aires, and is a close friend of Martin Bormann. I made the mistake of writing to him at his residence in Buenos Aires, asking for an interview and giving him the name of my publisher at that time. It took no time at all for him to make a telephone call from his residence to Dusseldorf and issue the firm suggestion to the Dutch-German owners of this New York publishing house that the Paul Manning biography of Martin Bormann be put aside. By the way, interrupting, in FTRs 122 and 123, I went into the German corporate control of American publishing. The apparently Odessa-linked firm von Holtzbrinck, one of whose primary personnel, Michael Naumann, is now the German cultural minister, and the even more important Bertelsmann company dominate American publishing. Bertelsmann's founder, Heinrich Mohn, had been in the SS in World War II. His son had been with the elite Hermann Göring division, that's Reinhard Mohn, and one of Reinhard Mohn's proteges is the head of Thiessen AG. And with Thiessen AG's major connections to the Bormann Group, I noted that in those two pairs of half-hour segments, again, FTRs 122 and 123, and observing the role not only of Count Federico Zichy Thiessen, but also other corporations connected through West German or German industry, and through that, inevitably, to the Bormann Organization, effected the deep sixing of the Martin Bormann book, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. Some of my concerns about the German corporate control of American publishing could be exemplified with this particular model, because I think it presents a model for the censoring of American academia and American journalism, even beyond the level to which it is already censored, and that is plenty damn censored. And again, this is one of the many reasons why I think the Bormann Organization is going to prove to be the dominant element in human affairs on this planet, and I believe that the future will be Hitler's, so to speak, through the Bormann Organization. Perhaps I'm wrong, and again, as I've said before, rather than criticize me for my analysis, and I strive for accurate analysis, if you don't like that analysis, get out and try to change the future. I'm interested here in accurate analysis. Continuing. Then there was a far-reaching but hidden clout exercised by major German multinationals, mentioning to their U.S. corporations and corporate friends that it would be appreciated if Paul Manning's book never appeared. Those suggestions were, so to speak, passed along publishing and Agent Rowe in New York City. When the book did appear, it was placed in low profile in most bookstores. Yet it became a steady seller in bookstores on Fifth Avenue and across the country. But at no time was it reviewed by the New York Times. It was as if the word had gone out from certain people in Washington that this book was to be deep-sixed by being ignored. I could understand the position of the New York Times. They have been susceptible to official Washington influence ever since the late Arthur Hayes Sulzberger agreed to let CIA agents become Times stringers at various overseas posts, just as did other New York publications like Time and Life, which also declined to review my book, as did Newsweek magazine.
That again from News World, August 24th, 1982, in turn excerpted from For the Record 152 from February of 1999. Right back into For the Record 152 for the News World follow-up from the next day. That next day was August 25th of 1982. This excerpt contains a synopsized account of what the Bormann Organization is and talks about the fact that the tremendous power embodied in it, if it were truly revealed, could besmirch people on this side of the Atlantic as well as on that side of the Atlantic.
This article reads, after an introduction, "From my prime connections to the Bormann Organization, I learned that certain high officials within the U.S. State Department had assisted in the flight of Martin Bormann and his elite SS leadership from Germany to South America after World War II. One German, who himself had provided Bormann with a safe house for 10 days following the Reichsleiter's escape from the Führer bunker on May 1st and 2nd, 1945, and had subsequently traveled to South America to work for Bormann there, told me that the Bormann leadership are concerned that worldwide publicity by me of the Bormann story would reveal the fact that U.S. Embassy, consular, and secret intelligence agents high in the U.S. State Department had helped Bormann and the SS leadership reach havens in South America. But the biggest problem I have encountered in winning public acceptance of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, has been the artful and unremitting campaign of disinformation waged by General Heinrich Mueller, wartime head of the Gestapo. Since 1947, he has acted as chief of security in South America for the Bormann Organization. It was he who discredited Ladislaus Farrago, author and journalist. Farrago wrote the Bormann story in 1973 for the London Daily Express, the Chicago Tribune Syndicate, and their New York outlet, the Daily News. The facts behind this discreditation should be of interest to editors and reporters everywhere. As his ploy to discredit Farrago while he was tracking Bormann in South America, Mueller's agent supplied Farrago with forged documents. When he had gained the author's confidence, he sold him a photograph purporting to be that of Bormann and an Argentine secret agent at a Chilean checkpoint. Predictably, the documents and the published photograph received worldwide press attention. Thereupon, Mueller dispatched another agent to the Buenos Aires office of the New York Times. This one revealed that the photograph was not of Bormann at all, but was rather of a high school teacher and his companion. He invited the Times man to bring a camera, and they went together to the high school where the teacher and his friend were once again posed against the background identical to that in the original photograph. This second photo was released worldwide by the New York Times, and responsibility for the hoax was laid on Farrago, who was thus discredited all down the line, with most editors naively assuming that Farrago had done the misrepresenting. It was misinformation at its most skillful and sly. But the effects on U.S. journalism, and on editors in general was more devastating than on Farrago himself, who was deeply distressed at having been taken in. However, he went on to write the famous General Patton book that made him a fortune. By the way, Farrago also wrote The Game of the Foxes and another book, Burn After Reading. Continuing, American journalism slipped simply because the search for objective truth in this matter had faltered. The whopping lie that Bormann had died in Berlin had been orchestrated and sponsored by Willy Brandt and primed from South America by Mueller and successive German governments. So artful were they that the cover-up was accepted as truth by too many American editors who then couldn't square it with my own valid reporting of the true Bormann epic. My research and my credentials will stand up alongside of those of almost any editor in the United States. The KGB is expert at disinformation, but Mueller and his organization of spies and manipulators of media are far more skilled and solidly effective. The U.S. spokesman for the Simon Wiesenthal Group calls the Mueller organization the best intelligence outfit in the world today. My background and reputation for accuracy in reporting was disdained after the West German Chancellor staged a 1973 press conference in Frankfurt. At this occasion, there was exhibited a skull found in the Berlin freight yards and proclaimed to be that of Martin Bormann, thus proving that the former Reichsleiter was dead and gone and no one should bother looking for him. American editors took this story at face value, but wiser and more experienced editors in Europe knew it to be false. The attempt was termed a whitewash, unquote, by responsible journalists abroad. The London Daily Express named it for what it was, quote, Bormann's perpetual passport to freedom, unquote. It is simply a fact that the Israeli Secret Service has never closed its books on Bormann. They know he is in South America, but they don't particularly care. He was not one of those responsible for the final solution. That was Himmler's problem, Bormann stated, nor do the Americans, the British, the French, or the Russians want him. Indeed, the Allies of World War II can't afford to hunt him down and lay open to public knowledge his activities and achievements. All the above, together with West Germany, owe him too much. In the final year of the war, the U.S. Treasury Department was aware of German looting of Europe and the Third Reich. Orvis A. Schmidt, director of Foreign Funds Control, even told a U.S. Senate committee on June 25, 1945, that, quote, the Department of State has abundant evidence that the Nazis, in anticipation of military defeat, made careful plans to carry on in foreign countries a wide range of activities necessary to support an eventual resurgence of German power. For this purpose, plans were made and carried out in part to transfer sufficient funds and specifically trained personnel to carry on pan-German activities. In anticipation of Allied victory, thousands of IG Farben secrets went underground along with other German resources. Unquote. Today, through bearer bonds representing investments in German, Dutch, Swedish, Swiss, French, Latin American, and U.S. corporations, together with his control of the trust established and turned over to Bormann by the late Hermann Schmitz, who was president and chief executive officer of IG Farben, Bormann and his organization represent the largest accumulation of financial power ever assembled under one control. For one example, the four successor firms to Farben, Hoechst, BASF, Bayer, and Cassata Farbenwerke, have grown to be the four largest chemical corporations in the world. Each is more prosperous than the original Farben at its zenith. It is such success, also generated by the 750 corporations established by Bormann in the neutral nations during the last year of World War II, that served as economic bastions for the Federal Republic of Germany. This has made Bormann the man largely responsible for West Germany's post-war recovery. And in the process, individuals in Washington, New York, London, Paris, and Bonn who attached themselves to this figure and his organization became themselves immensely wealthy and certainly do not want waves by an American author and his research. Bormann has, of course, long since read my book at his home in Argentina. The word I got back regarding his reaction, quote, it is a good book. However, in regard to its contents, you will not receive any great financial profit or success from it, unquote. I know now he was right. I have also learned what a downhold can do to the success of a book. But there are independent editors across the country who have liked and have been impressed by its ring of truth. The West Coast Review of Books gave it a 4-star rating, concluding its review with, definitely an eye-opener for readers, unquote. The Sunday Press of Atlantic City gave it an excellent review, concluding, as pages unfold, the reader is more convinced that the entire truths of the final days of World War II have never been told. Manning's book raises many questions, including how many more top Nazis are still living in splendor throughout the world, including America, enjoying their ill-gotten spoils, unquote. The answer to this lies in the discussion reported by Time magazine from Basel, Switzerland, during the period when the United States had a balance of payments crisis. In the headquarters of the World Monetary Fund, it was discovered that there was $15 billion in circulation that should not really exist. Time questioned, quote, "One wonders where that amount of money came from," unquote. It was Bormann Organization funds, part of the entire Reichsbank treasure that had been shifted from Berlin to Switzerland under control of Reichsleiter Martin Bormann. This treasure was only part of the wealth transferred by Bormann to neutral countries in the last months of the war. It is listed in the Guinness Book of World Records under the greatest unsolved robbery.
That again from For the Record 152 Side A from February of 99, in turn excerpted from the now defunct News World of August 25th of 1982. What we're going to do next is to listen to just who happened to be leading the media charge against Ladislaus Farago, who, as we saw, was the focal point of a media discreditation effort by Heinrich Mueller, the security director for the Bormann Group. The person leading the media charge was Gerald Posner. The journalistic attack on Ladislaus Farago in his book Aftermath in the United States was led by a writer who has since become quite well known for launching attacks on generally creditable theses, namely a fellow named Gerald Posner, who has become quite famous in recent years for endorsing the official and altogether untenable orthodoxy with regard to the assassinations of President Kennedy and, more recently, Martin Luther King. Gerald Posner wrote a book called Case Closed, which endorses the nonsense dredged up by the Warren Commission. He has most recently written a book called Killing the Dream, which endorses the official James Earl Ray, the lone nut, did it nonsense with regard to the assassination of Martin Luther King. The earlier attack by Gerald Posner on Ladislaus Farago and his book Aftermath is discussed in a book called Unholy Alliance, subtitled A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult. That book was authored by Peter Levenda, last name L-E-V-E-N-D-A, was published in softcover by Avon Books and copyright 1995. And there's a discussion in this book of Posner's attack on Farago and Aftermath. Levenda writes, "One of the shrillest critics of Farago's work is Gerald L. Posner, whose latest offering, Case Closed, purports to prove, unquote, the Warren Commission's findings that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in the assassination of President Kennedy. Posner attacked Farago in a book co-authored with BBC television producer John Ware entitled Mengele, The Complete Story. In this work, begun safely 2 years after Mengele's death in Brazil, Farago was needlessly and brutally characterized as an incompetent venal swindler who was duped at every turn in his quest for Mengele, a quest which resulted, says Posner, in the murder of an innocent man wrongly assumed to be Mengele. Incredibly, Posner lays this crime at Farago's door, an ironic leap for someone who criticizes the JFK conspiracy theorists for similar, quote, leaps, unquote. We may be certain that Mr. Posner will provide the reading public with more such proofs in the future in his zealous defense of government-approved cover stories and socially acceptable mythology." By the way, this forecast in 1995 proved altogether prescient, as witnessed by the recent publication by Posner of Killing the Dream. Continuing. "Perhaps a book that will prove that Senator Joe McCarthy's famous list of suspected communists in the U.S. government was genuine, or a study proving that George Bush had nothing at all to do with Iran-Contra." By the way, the attempted resurrection of Joe McCarthy is in full swing. Peter Levenda's discussion of Gerald Posner's attack on the credibility of Ladislaus Farago. In light of some of Posner's other efforts, I don't think it is an altogether unfair question to ask whether when Heinrich Mueller was saying, "The world is a chessboard and editors are my pawns," unquote, Gerald Posner might have been one of those pawns of Heinrich Mueller. That again from For the Record 134, in turn excerpted from a letter from Paul Manning to William Leonard, then the head of CBS News, November 1st, 1981, none other than Gerald Posner leading the media rush to discredit Ladislaus Farago. Eventually, in his decades-long, really lifelong search to uncover the truth, concerning the Borman Capital and Political Network. Paul Manning was able to use his connections to get a hold of a file that was opened on Martin Borman by the FBI, specifically at a request from then-President Harry Truman, who used then-Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court Robert Jackson as his intermediary to get Hoover's FBI to open a surveillance file on Martin Borman. That they did, and among the information contained in it and reported by Paul Manning are Borman's banking records. That file, again, maintained by the FBI at the request of President Truman beginning in 1948. The file revealed that Borman had been banking under his own name from his office in Germany at Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires since 1941, that he held one joint account with the Argentinian dictator Juan Perón, and that on August 4th, 5th, and 14th of 1967, had written checks on demand accounts in First National City Bank Overseas Division of New York, the Chase Manhattan Bank, and Manufacturers Hanover Trust Company, all three cleared through Deutsche Bank of Buenos Aires. Those, again, were written on August 4th, 5th, and 14th of 1967. Not bad for somebody who was killed in 1945, eh? That concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 604, Kicking Over the Traces. In order to flesh out your understanding of the material spoken about here, please use the Spitfire website and the linked websites in particular, not only the actual book from which you've just heard, the book you've heard excerpted, Martin Borman, Nazi in Exile, but also the documents linking the Bush family's operations to this same network and the many, many other online resources available at www.spitfirelist.com, including a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record program number 604, Kicking Over the Traces. This is being recorded on July 15th of 2007. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.